You looked confused there. I didn't know if you had something to say or
I'm
not.
I'm using the crappy App Store app and wondering why there's even a thing. It's just so bad. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 6 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
Don't know about you, Sean, but I am busy preparing for the Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales period. Now, I've already had folks email me asking whether my books will be on sale during that period, because last year I ran a huge sale. But honestly, I think most of my time is spent creating a silly After Effects video advertising the sale. So obviously that's what I'm busy doing right now. What about you?
So I've had my head down. I got a pretty big deadline coming up that we'll talk about later in the episode. But so what are you telling me? Are you telling me that I should hold off on buying your testing book for the sale? Are you telling me not to buy it right now? Hold off.
That book comes out very soon. By the time this is released, I think release day of this podcast. So there's not enough time between then and the Black Friday sales to include it in the sale, I'm afraid. So it won't be in the sale. Every other book will be in the sale except that one. It's just not fair on people who pre-ordered. So no, go ahead and buy now.
So what you're saying, wait till next year. Okay, got it. All right, Paul, let's dive into some news. The first story we're going to talk about is a strange proposed final ABI, which is Application Binary Interface, is now on master. What does that mean? Basically, Swift strings are now stored as UTF-8, where they were previously stored as ASCII or UTF-16, depending on the content. This brings some significant performance wins, as well as cuts down the size of the standard library.
Yeah, so the standard library binary is actually around 13% smaller with that change. 13% smaller, that one, well, relatively large change, which will make a huge difference for any folks targeting devices where Swift's libraries aren't pre-installed after the ABI freeze.
Yeah, it seems kind of crazy to me that just changing strings gives that much savings. But this also seems to be, you know, just the first step, right? From reading the post they posted, it sounds like in the future they'll be exposing more lower-level APIs for even more performance gains down the line.
We'll have to wait and see.
All right, Paul, did you know that there was an event on October 30th where Apple launched some new products? Do you know about that?
Me and the whole rest of the world.
Right. Well, so we announced some new products, the MacBook Air, the Mac Mini, and the new iPad Pro. So with the MacBook Air, it is 2018, and we're now finally getting a Retina display on the MacBook Air. That seems kind of crazy to me. We also got our first update on the Mac Mini since 2012. So you can see a trend here. Some products that were long overdue for an upgrade are finally getting the love they deserve. And then finally, the star of the show was the redesigned iPad Pro and the new Apple Pencil. So, Paul, so far, I've resisted the urge. I haven't broken out my wallet and bought anything yet. How about you? Are you staying strong? You bought anything yet?
Well, I just got the XS Max and I got the Watch Series 4, but I've got a second-gen 12.9-inch iPad Pro, which is an amazing device. You know, I briefly considered upgrading if only to have the device become a little bit smaller, but what does it do that my current one doesn't do, right? You know, pretty much nothing. I don't use the pen. And in fact, I actually just use it mostly for watching movies on the many plane journeys I take.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I actually sold my 9.7-inch iPad Pro and Pencil, because I never used it. The Pencil was a novelty to me. Don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking it. I'm sure it's amazing for artists, but just for me, I just didn't use it. But one thing that after this announcement, you know, the iPad is getting more computer-like, so there's a lot of debate on Xcode for iPad in the iOS developer community. So, Paul, what's your take on that?
I think we've seen some great benchmarks of folks running things, saying, look how fast the A12X is, and it's very, very fast. No one doubts that. And of course, when next year and the year after and the year after, it'll get faster and faster again. We're just seeing this incredible performance curve from Apple. But we don't know how well Swift compiles. Our gut says screamingly fast, right, compared to, you know, even a MacBook Pro. But we don't know. Now, Apple has been on a mission to upgrade some of the older parts of Xcode. And, you know, Xcode 9 was a huge step forward, the great new source editor being super smooth. But it was taken straight from the Swift implementation they'd done for iPad. They'd moved it from iPad to Mac. And that's fine, but moving all of Xcode across from iPad, or to iPad, sorry, is going to take quite a long time, I think. Now, I expect it's been underway for some time, either as a Skunkworks project or for RealWorks, we don't really know. But when Apple finally ditches UIKit and AppKit for whatever their inevitable replacement is, that might be the time we see Xcode for iPad.
Yeah, I'm for it. I mentioned it in Swift News talking about like an Xcode Lite, because I agree with you. It is going to take a while to bring the entire thing over. But Right now we have nothing, so nothing is better than, something is better than nothing. So I can't wait to see what they do with it, because I agree with you. I do think it's underway. And another interesting thing about this iPad is a lot of people are saying, like you mentioned, when Apple finally ditches UIKit, in-app kit for the, Marzipan code name, in iOS 13, and everybody thinks 2019 WWDC is going to be a big year for unveiling. So I think we're only seeing half the story with this iPad Pro. And I think the iPad Pro is kind of laying its foundation for what it can really do once all this new stuff comes out next year. Up next, we have the aptly named Sherlock, which is a new app that essentially gives your simulator in Xcode some superpowers. And I say it's aptly named because it's such a cool product that it has a very high likelihood of getting Sherlocked. What is getting Sherlocked? Most of you may know, some of you may not. Basically, that is when you create a feature or an app by yourself. Apple likes it so much, they decide to build it into their system. A good example is the Flashlight app from way back in the day. Now that's built into the system. And more recently, all the ARKit measurement apps that people made when ARKit first came out. Yeah, Apple said, good idea, we're going to make our own. And now it's comes with the system. So what does Sherlock do? Not what I just explained, but the actual app we're talking about. So basically, it allows you to edit views in real time, simulate running on other devices, and debug visual issues. Now, this just popped up in my Twitter feed a day or two before we're recording, so I haven't really had a chance to dive in and play with it. I just kind of checked out the website and was amazed by all the GIFs on Twitter. This looks amazing, Paul. What do you think?
Honestly, it is amazing, and it's weird how few folks noticed it was actually around. You know, their announcement, the folks who made this thing, their announcement had maybe two or three retweets, but my tweet about it had over 300 likes and 100 retweets. It's really raised their profile. And, you know, it works. It is exactly what it says it will do. Now, I've jumped into system apps like settings or photos or maps, whatever, and I've just monkeyed around with them out of curiosity. It's really great fun to explore Apple stuff, poke around and change it live in the simulator.
So what are you trying to say, Paul? Are you trying to be the chief marketing officer for Sherlock?
I'm going to write an article about it, I think, because I think people are saying, firstly, does it do what it says? Answer, yes. And secondly, how does it work? And I've asked them that, if they'll tell me a few hints here and there, because I am deeply curious. So you can expect a new article on the site soon, hopefully with some answers from the creators.
All right, moving on, let's talk about the App Store Connect API is now available. Now, this was announced in WWDC over the summer, but now it's actually ready for use. What this means is you can create your own applications using information from App Store Connect. At the moment, there's only a couple endpoints. Because they just launched this, I imagine there will be more and more as the years go by. But right now, the functionality is pretty much limited to this. You can have endpoints for test flight, which is manage your beta, builds of your app, testers, groups, etc. You can manage users and access, so you can send invites to your team. You can also adjust their access or remove the user. And then there's reporting, where you can download sales and financial reports.
You know, this is one of those things that seems like it could be interesting, but honestly, we'll have to wait and see what other folks build with it, because you look at the App Store Connect app for iOS, which I've got on my phone right now, I'm looking at it right now, and it's just not very good. It doesn't do very much. So it's hard to have a very high target to beat here, quite frankly. Do a few more things than that, like test flight, for example, a fairly important feature these days. Add that, and you're already better than the crowd.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of that, Antoine Vanderlee has a nice blog post up discussing some of the possibilities, like you just mentioned. A test flight manager where you could add new beta testers, submit new builds. You can use the sales and financial reporting to create an app for your growth team. So this is more relevant to maybe a larger team, but it is important to note that you cannot submit an app to the App Store using the API. So this is for, internal team use only. All right, Paul, up next we have our picks. What do you got for us?
So this week I want to talk about using URL protocol for mocking in tests. As regular listeners, in fact, anyone been awake in the last few minutes will know, I'm in the final stages of writing a new book about testing Swift, cuttingly called Testing Swift.
How long did it take you to think of that one?
It's more about sticking a flag in the territory saying, this is mine. I've got the ultimate Google SEO right there.
There you go.
Anyway, I'm busy writing up the chapter on test doubles, and in particular, looking at how we create mocks for networking.
So as I've mentioned before, I need to up my testing games. I know mocking is kind of like mocking the data, but could you clarify that a little bit?
Well, two of the important things about unit tests, two of the five things about unit tests is they should be fast and they should be reliable. And if you were to describe networking to someone else, two words you wouldn't use are fast and reliable, right? You just wouldn't do it. So it's common to hide networking code behind a protocol where we can insert some sort of fake networking code in our tests so that our unit tests are faster and are reliable. Anyway, one of the notes I'd made for the book referenced a video from WW18 called Testing Tips and Tricks. It's got Brian Croom, and I think maybe someone else in there as well. Anyway, it's a great video. And in that presentation, they talked about something that had been in iOS since iOS 7. So, quite frankly, a long time. And that is the protocol classes property of URL session configuration. Now, we're used to using URL session performing tasks. We use things like URL session data task or fetching data, for example. But underneath that lies a whole series of URL protocol implementations that handle reading and writing requests. Things like HTTPS, for example. That's done for us by the system. We don't care how it works. Now, URL protocol is designed to be subclassed. And this protocol class's property lets us inject our custom protocols directly into Apple's networking API stack for testing purposes, which gives us complete control over the way networking requests are handled.
So that's interesting. You said it was designed to be subclassed. So that's what lets us override this default behavior?
Well, honestly, it's a bit weird. Apple's official docs say, quoting from their docs, the URL session object searches the default protocols first and then checks your custom protocols until it finds one capable of handling the specified request. But in practice, I've literally just been typing the code out. Our custom protocols get used first. And I literally tried it. Using a default config, I can fetch data over HTTPS. But injecting my own protocol class means it gets created instead, which is way nicer. You can make networking behave however you want without having to subclass or otherwise mock URL session. So that's my pick this week is there's a way, way nicer way to do networking but testing using this protocol classes property. What about you, Sean? What do you got?
So my pick this week is a blog post from Intercom titled Embracing the Deadline, How Engineers Can Benefit from Delivery Dates. And I chose this because it hits really close to home this week. I'm delivering by the end of this week. We're recording a little earlier on a Wednesday. So by Friday, I have to have a major build for home user testing done. In fact, I probably should be working on that right now. But, the show must go on. Care about the audience. Got to get a show out. So it'll be a late night tonight. But anyway, but when dealing with the stress of deadlines, and this is like from the article, like it's important to remember that the number of hours you work isn't the only variable you can change. For example, there's a good quote in the article that says, success is shipping the best product we can, not a set of features we'd agreed upon months ago. And that's so true because when you talk about things months ago, things change, things come up. And so I just really love that quote. And kind of back to what I said is you don't have to just work more hours to get it done. You can change the scope of the project, or maybe there's a simpler version of the implementation you can do rather than doing the fully robust one, etc.
Or just move the deadline back. One of my all-time favorite games creator, Shigeru Miyamoto, who created Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong, Pikmin, and more, his great quote says, a delayed game is eventually good. A bad game is bad forever.
And yeah, I actually really, really love that quote because it does make sense, but it is a little different because back then, once you released the game, you couldn't, send out a patch and fix something, right? That was the game. So delays were probably more common back then. But anyway, like I mentioned, Paul, I've been stressing about this deadline, but I'm kind of curious, your deadlines are self-imposed. So for example, recently I saw on Twitter, you kind of had this little bit of a mad dash to release a bunch of stuff by the end of October. So I'm curious how you handle your self-imposed deadlines, because that's a little different, than, a launch date of a product or home user testing or whatever. So let's hear it.
It wasn't really a mad dash. I even managed to slip in one bonus thing. I had this hoodie of truth now for sale on the site. But one of the tasks, to be fair, was updating all my books for Swift 4.2. And every year, because I launch new books, these updates take longer to do. So this one took longer than I planned. So that took a while, I agree. Plus, I'm also really bad at volunteering for extra work, even when I know I'm certain I'm busy already. I spoke at 3 different events. I taught a workshop at my local university. I wrapped up a huge architecture review for a client. And I even managed a week of vacation. So I crammed a lot in, it's true. But I feel that deadline slippage is normal and nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the article does go on to discuss good ways to craft deadlines, which I thought was pretty interesting for anybody out there that's trying to figure out how to come up with this. But it's basically important for everybody on the team to understand, one, why the deadline matters, how it was chosen, and then the team should feel like they have input on it. And that's my big thing when dealing with my own personal deadlines at work, you know, as long as I understand like why this date is the date and how that came about, then I don't mind if it's a super tight deadline because I understand the reasoning behind it. And maybe I'm a little weird. I know this may be, I don't know, maybe I'm just weird, but I actually like that up back up against the wall, up against a deadline, right? You're down in the trenches with your teammates trying to get this out on time. Now I want to stress. I don't like that every day, all day, every day. Like, but once, maybe twice a year, I think that's fun. I don't know. Am I crazy? Am I the only one that feels that way?
I think it's a great quote from Patrick Lencioni. I love. He wrote a book called The Advantage. And he says that if you don't give team members the chance to weigh in on something, they won't buy into that thing. So yes, it's important to let folks decide themselves where the deadline comes from, how it's chosen, to have input on it. Otherwise, they'll never enjoy it. Even twice a year, they'll hate it. Okay, let's move on to our open ballot. The question this episode was suggested by listener Mr. J. Ive, and the question is this: should user interfaces surprise and delight users, or is it better to be functional? And this has been a topic since the very first releases of iOS, but the battle really intensified when iOS 7 was announced, of course, and skeuomorphism was largely removed, all that lovely wood and felt and so forth, they were all tossed away, and apps took on a much more stark look.
Speaking of Mr. J. Ive, where was he during the Apple event? I saw two beautiful Apple marketing videos. No Johnny Ive. I was very disappointed.
He's locked in his room planning the next super, super, super thin MacBook Pro, razor sharp. Anyway, let's take a look at what our listeners said. Our pal Mark O'Pont jumped in straight away saying, slightly cheatily, quite frankly, functionally delight. So, of course, I challenge him in this saying, is it better or worse than delightfully functional? And finally, got a real answer. It's better because it's functional before it's delightful. The common user downloaded your app because of a specific function. And Cyril Garcia said, an app that's both functional and delightful to use is a compliment to your users because it shows not only are you thinking about solving a particular problem, but you also took the time to make them feel good about using your app. I think that last part for me really nails it. I want users to feel good about using the app because they've spent, you know, $1,000 or more dollars buying this expensive device in their pocket. And of course, Apple lavished the software with love and polish and so forth. And I want users to feel the same sort of warm glow about my software too, that it does feel as good, you know, up to par with the rest of the system.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. My favorite part about development and building these apps is building the customer-facing, you know, user interface. Like, I love watching people use apps that I've built and seeing that delight on their face. So I do agree functionality has to come first, right? You don't just want to have animations playing everywhere for no reason, but the delight is so important to me, so I agree.
Yeah, so Drew Westcott agrees. He said, I'd always say functional has to be the starting point, then delight as much on top of that base. And Alec Pirfan said, the UI should always be delightful, even if it's supposed to do simple stuff. Yes, it may be confusing at first, but given time the users learn how to use the app, they'll never stop loving the way it looks.
This is kind of an interesting point because I know a lot of times I build app, I want to make sure I use the common, you know, design patterns so users will instinctively know how to use the app, things like, you know, the bottom tab bar, etc. But this is interesting that, yes, after you get over that initial learning curve, it may be super delightful if you come up with something brand new. Now, I'm going to throw Snapchat out there. Love it or hate it, they came up with a completely different, you know, design and UI pattern that users eventually loved. And that was actually arguably their strongest selling point because it was just for the kids. The adults and the grownups in the room didn't know how to use the app. So it can actually benefit you.
That is exactly the same example I would have given because it's exactly right. I've tried using Snapchat. I don't get it. And I'm not supposed to get it, quite frankly. You know, I'm in my 30s. I'm not the target group. They want to be niche. They want to be unusual and weird and so forth. And in fact, when they changed their UI to be more sensible and more discoverable, people revolted. So it's a real problem. Yeah. But what I worry about is that if an app is confusing at first, I just delete it. You know, life's too short. There are 50 other apps doing similar things out there. If your Sudoku game or something isn't immediately good to me, poof, delete, download another one. It's so fast to do. I haven't got the patience for anything more than that.
Yeah, that's kind of the gamble Snapchat took. It worked out for them, but kind of like you said, I bet for 99 out of 100 companies, that won't work out. You know, they just, I don't know if they got lucky or what, but it worked for them.
Yariv Nassim gave a great point about animations. He said they should serve a purpose and be short and interactive. They should show the user where to look, where they're going, how to go back, what's the next call to action, and be subtle and non-intrusive. If they slow us down, they're wasting our time, and long animations get annoying pretty quickly. Functionality comes first. Now, he's absolutely nailed it here about the point of animations. They are designed to guide your eye from A to B. So if you delete an email or delete a note, you can see the note going somewhere, and you know how to look for that thing after it's been moved. The exception, the only exception I've found, I think, so far, is one that doesn't even exist anymore. It's the old Apple Passbook delete a pass animation. Absolutely adored. You have a little sort of like airplane boarding pass or a ticket, and you say delete, and a shredder would appear and slice it into small bits, and it'd sort of fall away in 3D. It looked incredible. And the new animations are sort of like a TV turning off animation, which is really tedious and nowhere near as much fun. So I kind of used to actually add a pass, delete it, add it again, delete it, just to admire this gorgeous animation.
That's interesting. I never actually used the Passbook app back then, so I never even saw that. Didn't know that exists, so I learned something today. But as far as what Yariv says, I agree 1,000%. And I've had this argument just recently at my company because we're building an app for children, and the tutorial is coming into play where they want tooltips and text pointing to stuff. And I'm like, no, it has to be subtle animation showing the user how to do it. We used Angry Birds as the example. Like, Angry Birds has no text when it's showing you how to play the game. So I agree, subtle animations are a very good way to show people how to use your app.
Inevitably, like in every episode, we get folks saying, it depends. Kristaps Grimberg says, depends on the use case. If it's statistics, a work tool, then more functional, because too much nice design can hurt using it. If it's more consumer-based, then delight users. And Matt Sanford said, if the app's a quick utility like a garage door opener, make it functional. If I'm going to spend a lot of time in it, like a banking app, I want a more elegant experience. And that's interesting. I, of all the apps I'd want to be delightful and surprising, I think a banking app is the last one I choose. I don't want to be surprised in a banking app, quite frankly. It's the last place I want it.
I know, Paul, you stole my line. I was going to say the same thing. I was like, really? I would have thought he would have said something else, like a banking app. I was really surprised when I saw that.
Hey, you got the Snapchat in there before I did, so you know, quid pro quo.
Fair is fair. Fair is fair. All right. I'll give you that. So obviously the it depends answer is probably always going to be right because it covers all bases. So of course I agree with what they said. If it's, you know, super simple, just go for the functionality. But the real point is this answer of it depends, like that really is going to cover all the bases. And this is probably the correct answer. And I obviously agree with what they said. If it's a super simple app, make it functional. If there's reason to delight the user, go ahead and delight them.
Let's end on a nice easy one from our friend Swifty McSwiftface. He says, I'm surprised and delighted by great functionality. A good example is the Buy Now button on Amazon's app. It looks okay, but it's a joy to see all order info on half a screen and swipe to place. Now, if you remember the old swipe to unlock from the original iPhones and so forth, it's that. They've taken that exact UI and put it into the Amazon app, and I agree, it is still beautiful.
All right, that's going to wrap up this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But before we go, we want to leave you with next week's open ballot. And that is, what's your favorite part about writing iOS apps with Swift?
Or macOS, or watchOS, or even tvOS for that one person once.
Right. I want tvOS to take off. I want it to be better. But anyway, tell your friends to subscribe and follow us on Twitter @SwiftOverCoffee. We'll see you in the next one.
Bye.